Welcome to the Learning Curve, your industry podcast on all things on enterprise learning. In this episode of the Learning Curve with me, Kenny, I have a very exciting topic today, and that would be hybrid onboarding. As always, I have a guest who is also an expert in the field, and the guest with me today is Dr. William Thomas, Principal Executive Onboarding Partner at Amazon Web Services, based in Singapore. So hopefully I've piqued your interest on the topic. If not, then let me add one other thing, and that would be marathon. Now you might be asking, what does marathon have to do with onboarding? Hybrid onboarding as such? Well, you'll just have to listen to the episode and find out where it takes us. So hi, and welcome to another episode of The Learning Curve with me, Kenny. Today, we're going to have a really, really, really interesting topic. Today, our topic is hybrid onboarding, empowering new Amazon executives with cultural fluency. Wow, that was probably one of the longer titles that I had today. And with me today is William Thomas, and he's the Principal Executive Onboarding Partner at Amazon Web Services in Singapore. So, hi, William.
Hi, Kenny. Thanks so much for having me here today. Very, very excited to talk with you.
Oh, and I'm excited to talk to you. So, first of all, I can call you Will, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, yeah. Fine. Then, Will, I'll go right off topic because since I met you, of course, the first thing you do is, of course, snooze a little bit on social media. And before we get into the real introduction of you and everything, I have a personal question I have to ask. Okay. What made you come up with a Grand Slam marathon? Can you tell me that? I never even knew that there was such a thing as a Grand Slam marathon. And the first thing that when I schnoozed your social profile, that came up. I'm like, what? I was completely shocked. I didn't know that even existed. So maybe tell our listeners there what motivated you, first of all, to get into marathons, and then that not being enough, that you decide to do a Grand Slam marathon, which I don't think very many people actually know what it is. And I think that's really fascinating. So maybe you can touch on those two topics before we get into all the other introduction stuff and all the on-topic stuff.
Sure, I'd be very happy to. And you got to be careful. You get me start talking about running, and we may never get off of that. But yeah, I can tell you that just a bit about how I got into it, and then how the Grand Slam came up. And I will say I've actually written a book on the subject, so I'm going to give you the abridged version of chapter one, if you will, and get you there. So I started running fairly late in life compared to a lot of runners. I was 42 by the time I got started. And what had happened was I was in the military. I was an Air Force officer, a U.S. Air Force officer. And I'd been in Afghanistan for a period of time. And my colleagues were all from the Army. And so at the end of the day, we'd get back to our base camp and they'd all go work out because that's what the Army does, right?
Yeah,
and
Air Force.
Yeah, and I was
his office guys, right? The flyboys, so to say.
Exactly. You know, we may be a little different. All the running, jumping, climbing trees. We don't always do that sort of thing. But I was with the Army, so you know, when in Rome, you know, do what the Romans do.
Do like the Romans do. Okay.
Exactly. So I got out there with the gladiators, and you know, we'd run and lift and all that stuff. So when I got back to the States, I was in better shape than I'd been in for quite some time, and I wanted to keep that. And I knew that at a minimum, I should be running. But I also knew myself, and I know I'll do this for a little while and I'll get bored and get distracted and I'll give it up. And a friend of mine had just run the Marine Corps Marathon in Washington, D.C., which is where I was based. And he said, why don't you do this? He said, why don't you sign up to run this marathon with me next year so that you've got a goal and you don't quit? And he said, and tell everybody you're going to do it. And so once you put it out there on Facebook at the time, this is back in 2008, and you know, you announce it to the world, you've got to do it, right? You've got to run. Yeah. And so this was the thing, you know, running the marathon for me was just a way to keep myself running and get myself to go out and be fit. And what I realized as I got close to that race was I thought, wow, this is a lot of work for just one race. I should probably do some others. And so I kept going. And then a couple of years into it, I realized, okay, I'd had this goal of running a marathon. I'd done it. And I was afraid that, again, I might lose my motivation. I might lose that mojo. And so I looked around for something else. And I came across what's called the Marathon Grand Slam. And the idea behind that concept is that you run a marathon on each of the seven continents and at the North Pole. And that's
where it gets tricky.
That last one there, that last one was the tricky one. Antarctica was challenging enough. And that was my seventh continent. And I ran what's known as what's called the Antarctic Ice Marathon, which takes place at a base camp about 600 miles or 1,000 kilometers from the South Pole. And that was, you know, that was life changing. I mean, that's like, you know, some people go to the moon, other people go to Antarctica. And for me, it was Antarctica. And that was wild. But then about a year and a half later, I made my way to the North Pole. And there is a North Pole Marathon that is held there annually. When I was there, it was in the spring. They recently held one in the fall using an icebreaker to get to the North Pole. In our case, we flew in to a base camp on an ice floe there. And yeah, we ran 26.2 miles, 42.195 kilometers at the North Pole. And that was it. So there are, at this point, about 143 people who've accomplished the Grand Slam. I was number 82, not that I'm keeping count. But
but you did?
But I did. And yeah, and so I got that done. I got that done. And then, of course, the trick after that was to find another goal.
Okay. Well, that's incredible. Now, but this last question, then we'll get into our real topic here, or the main topic of our podcast. But how do you run a marathon in Antarctica and the North Pole? How does that work? I mean, are you walking? Or are you actually running? Is there a path? Do they just like cut in a lane of 2 miles and you go back and forth 42 times or, and the temperature, I mean, what? I mean, can you just take us through that for a quick second?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, when I ran Antarctica, that was in November of 2014. And at the time I was living in Singapore, which is pretty much right on the equator. When I ran North Pole in 2016, I was living in Bangkok, Thailand at the time, which is also in the tropics, of course. So the temperature change that you mentioned was pretty dramatic, you know, from 30 degrees Celsius here in Singapore to minus 30 degrees at a base camp in Antarctica. It was a bit of a shocker. The way they did the two races was a little bit different. So in Antarctica, you're actually on land. You know, you've got about a mile of snow and ice on top of that land, but you're actually on top of, there is land underneath. There's a continent underneath.
Somewhere,
you know, and the trick is to not fall in a hole and, you know, drop that mile down to where the land is. So what they did is they carved out a 21 kilometer loop. So basically a half marathon distance near this base camp. And they checked it with a ground sensing radar to make sure that it was in fact solid underneath. And it was not going to open up into one of these crevasses that would just drop us down to unrecoverable depths. So we went out and we ran this loop twice. And so they packed it down they'd driven a snow cat over it. So it was somewhat firm. There were areas where it was soft and you sunk into it. But the real challenge there was, of course, the temperature, the wind, snow blindness, frostbite, hypothermia, little things like that, that you just wanted to watch
tiny out. Little things like that. Okay.
Minor issues.
Nothing to mention.
Nothing really to make a big deal. So, and then I got to the North Pole, and that was a little more rustic, would be the word.
More rustic than the Antarctica. I mean,
a little more rustic, yeah. So we got there, and we were supposed to be there for about 36 hours. So they had to split the runners up between two planes because these are very small aircraft. And I was on the first one in, so we were waiting for the second one, and they carved out the course, and it was a 10 kilometer, an 8 kilometer loop, like an out and back, you know, 4 kilometers down, 4 kilometers back. So you kind of kept passing each other, and that was fine. And then there was a second piece of that, which was a 2.5 kilometer loop that we would then run four times to finish it out. And the first part seemed fairly packed down, like snowmobiles had been going over this, but the 2.5 clicks, it was at points knee deep. And, you know, I've looked at the video afterward and the race director is interviewed and he's saying, yeah, you know, the first 32K is going to be pretty manageable, but they're in for a surprise on the final 10. And he was not wrong about that.
I wasn't kidding.
He was not. I came up with swear words in multiple languages that day because it was not what I was expecting, and it was hard to keep moving. And I did, but the real challenge for us there at the pole was that, as I said, I was supposed to be there for about 36 hours, but before the second plane came in, the ice at the base camp cracked open, and in one direction it crossed over the marathon course, so they had to remark the course. But in the other direction, it cut our runway, so the plane couldn't come back in, and they had to build another runway. So instead of 36 hours, I was there for about 4.5 days.
And, oh my God!
And the meals kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And you know, we're looking around at each other, going, "Well, if we resort to cannibalism, we all run pretty fast, so it's going to be hard to, you know, catch anybody." So that was a little bit of a challenge. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But, fascinating.
It was a wonderful experience.
So yeah. this is the perfect segue because so you've seen pretty much all the seven continents. So you've gotten around. So you have a pretty good idea of what goes on. And today we want to talk about cultural onboarding in a global company. So you're a global individual, global company. That fits like a hand in glove. Okay. So your journey started in Washington and you moved to Singapore about 11 years ago. So how did this come up?
That was a surprising turn in my life, I will say. So as I said, I was an Air Force officer. I was stationed at the Pentagon for my last assignment. And an opportunity came up to teach as a Fulbright scholar over here in Singapore. Mm-hmm. Now, I have my PhD. I'd been a professor at the U.S. Air Force Academy. And my experience matched up perfectly with this opportunity. So I came over as a Fulbright scholar and taught here at a university in Singapore for 4 months in a master's degree program. Absolutely loved it. It was my first time living overseas. I'd been deployed in the military, but I'd never actually been stationed overseas. Mm-hmm. So I really had a great time here. And I went back to D.C., finished out my assignment. I retired at that point from the Air Force, and I was teaching at Georgetown University there in Washington. And my friends in Singapore said, "Well, we thought you were going to come back. So what's up with that?" And I said, "Yeah, what is up with that?" So I looked around and there was a U.S. consulting company. It was based in D.C. Mm-hmm. that was expanding their Singapore office. And I reached out to them and they thought my background would fit in really well. It was going to be advising chief HR officers in companies around Asia. And so, you know, they looked at my leadership background. They looked, I was teaching in a master's in HR management at Georgetown. They looked at my PhD and they said, "Come on over." So that was great. I thought this was going to be like a 2 or 3 year adventure. And as you said, it was over 11 years ago that I came. And in the interim, I ended up running my own business for about 6 years doing leadership coaching and leadership training. I moved to Bangkok for about 3.5 years. I then spent 2 years in Manila before coming back to Singapore a second time. So it's been quite a journey, that's for sure.
Okay, so you've had a chance to experience Asia in its various ways. I've only been in Singapore, but that was a short trip, and in China, and I must say Singapore is they kind of say the easy way in. To the Asian culture. And I thought after visiting China, I thought that was very much correct, simply because everything in Singapore, first of all, it's relatively small. So you can kind of, you know, get the lay of the land relatively easily. But everything also had always was in Latin writing, so you could always see, you could always read, you know, to a certain extent. When I got into China, that was different. So I couldn't read it. So that was pretty crazy. So how would you say when comparing U.S. to Asia cultural differences in like a quick block for our listeners there? How would you compare the two?
Yeah, I would say I think one thing to remember is that there is no single Asian culture. And I hear people talk about working in Asia or living in Asia or doing business in Asia. And the reality is that there is no such place as Asia. That's a line on a map that somebody
drew.
That's
a misconception.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there is, you know, there's obviously, you know, we call a continent, we call this region Asia. But the reality is that every country here is different, and every country has its own social culture and business culture, religious backgrounds, languages, foods. So many things are different. I could walk across the bridge from Singapore into Malaysia, and I'm in a very different setting as soon as I do that. So,
it's comparable to Europe. Then try you know, everybody, you know, would, if the misconception here is Europe, everybody kind of like it's lumped into one, but everybody has a clear understanding that it's kind of separate because you have France, you have England, so forth, and Italy. So, but when you talk about Asia, then you tend to lump everything together.
Yeah.
Right. Is that the general misconception? Okay.
It really is. And I think one reason for that is that there are some common themes that you see in different cultures across Asia, like reverence for the family, a bit of a communitarian spirit, which is still stronger in some places than in others, but does exist. So there are some common themes that you'll find. And I think sometimes outsiders will look at that and say, haha, well, this is all the same. And it really isn't. And I have to say, going back to your point about Singapore, that I'm very happy that I came to Singapore first before I moved to Bangkok, and certainly before I moved to Manila, because this is more of a blended society, if you will. There's Western and Eastern influences here. And then that set me up well for going to the others. Whereas I think if I'd gone straight on, say, to Manila from the US, it would have been a shocker. Yeah.
Definitely. Okay. So, so we're talking, so the topic today is, like I said, cultural onboarding in a global company. So, and you work for Amazon Web Services, which is, I would say, one of the biggest global companies we have. So let's get to the onboarding part then. So how are Amazon Web Services integrated into the Amazon family? So give us like a structure of Amazon, where we can place Amazon Web Services within the whole portfolio of Amazon. And then we'll get into the onboarding part by you telling us a little bit about how you experience your onboarding at Amazon.
Sure. Yeah. So so Amazon Web Services, or AWS, and I'll just use that term going forward.
I think that's that one everybody knows. There's too many commercials not to know it.
And it kind of depends on where you are too, because if you're in places where people don't watch a lot of television, live television, such as many places in Asia, you say, I work for AWS. And they say, well, what's that? And I say, well, I work for Amazon. Oh, okay. The Amazon, I know. And so that's the thing, you know, AWS of course is a part of Amazon. And so it came about years ago after about a decade of building and running this highly scalable web application called Amazon.com, Amazon realized that it had developed a core competency in building and operating these massive scale of, you know, technology infrastructure and data centers. And so it embarked on this new mission of serving a whole new segment of customers, you know, not just retail, but developers and businesses, and providing them with these web services similar to what we'd been using, that they could then use to build sophisticated and scalable systems. And so AWS got launched in 2006. And we are, as I said, part of the broader Amazon family. So we're in there with the Amazon.com or Amazon.sg, or, you know, the others, but also Amazon Devices, Prime Video, Amazon Fresh, and even some platforms like Internet Movie Database and Twitch, which I did not even know were part of Amazon until I got here.
I think they bought it.
but you know, the cool thing is, and I asked this question actually during my interviews, do people consider themselves part of AWS or part of Amazon? And what's helpful, I think, is while people will say, I work for AWS, but I'm an Amazonian. So regardless of what part of Amazon you work in, we still are part of this bigger, broader culture. And that's
okay.
That's,
so there is a unifying culture, which you said, you know, Amazonian, although there are, you know, various business units, and AWS is one of a spin-off off one of the core competencies that you had. You found out that you are very good at something else, and you're like, hey, why don't we make a business out of this? So, but overall, then you triggered me. My questions are all over now. Okay. But then I have the question. That is an interesting point, which I'm a little bit off topic, but how do you then achieve, because this is one of the biggest things, if you have so many business units, how do you achieve this overall cultural identity? Is that because I can, looking at other companies that I've worked in, I think it's aside from the military, which is clear, but other businesses, I think it's sometimes hard to identify as an overall, you know, the various business units identifying as a whole. Most of them say, you know, we're this business unit and the other one is our, you know, that's the main business unit, but there's no real overall community feeling. So how does that come about?
Yeah. So there are a couple of different things that I think really contribute to that global common cultural identity, that cohesive, really cohesive identity that, that we have. So within Amazon, we have 16 leadership principles that are really the glue that holds everybody together. And people live these. And these are not just, you know, statements on a poster that hangs in the break room. I mean, this is something that people really live. It's part of their vocabulary. It's part of the regular conversation. And what I've seen is, you know, since I've been here at Amazon, people hold themselves and hold each other accountable for those leadership principles. And I don't just mean a performance review time. I mean day to day. So the LPs, as we call them, the leadership principles, they describe how Amazon does its business, how leaders lead, and how we keep the customer really at the center of all of our decisions, because a lot of them really come back to this idea of customer obsession that we have. And it's really that set of principles that really holds us together in a global sense. Now, something that really brings us together even more at the local level and helps us to cross, you know, go across those business units would be a really strong network of affinity groups that we have within Amazon. Yeah, and we have a couple of dozen of these that include members from all of our businesses. We've got about, I think if you look across the company, there's about 90,000 members of different affinity groups in hundreds
of heading down a rabbit hole now. Affinity groups. You just, and one thing comes to the next. They'll say, I'm not familiar with affinity groups. What are affinity groups?
Sure. And I think I've heard other terms used before, like employee resource groups. Basically, it's almost like a club, if you will. So maybe it's the running group, or maybe it's women at Amazon, or it's parents at Amazon. So it's people with a common interest who come together. So, for example, I'm in a group called Warriors at Amazon. And that, as the name implies, is a group for veterans, for military veterans who've come in. So there are a lot of activities we do which involve outreach to veterans or support to veterans within or outside the company. And like I said, it brings people together from all the different business units. So I'm hanging out with somebody from Prime Video and somebody from the retail side and somebody from a data center. And they're not just American veterans. I should point out I've met other vets from the UK and India and Australia, some of whom were in the same place as I was at the same time doing similar things.
Okay, now I understand where you're coming from, because the interesting thing is I find it very interesting how it's applied, because in a different format we also have that here at the IMC, and that is in we now have this week we've had diversity weeks, a week in which we've talked about diversity in all its various phases and formats, and one of the topics that I was heading was diversity of interest, and that seems to align somewhat with your affinity groups, that basically the goal is to have people and individuals share something about what they do, what they're passionate about outside of work, but things that also then at the same time can be integrated into work. So let's just take your example for marathon running. I think I'm going to just say this, but one of the classical things you would say about a marathon runner is, what can you take from marathon to your work job? And maybe one of the things is persistence, that you have to stay with something until the end. And the path might be long, but you stick it through.
Right.
That would be an idea. Okay. Wow. Yeah. Fascinating. Okay. Yeah. So then let's get back to the onboarding part of this. So how does the whole onboarding process work for Amazon? How does Amazon Web Services ensure that the new hires receive the necessary training and resources to excel at their roles?
Okay. Well, let me focus in here on everybody, not just the executives, because I do executive onboarding, which is, you know, directors and GMs and vice presidents. But let me look at the broader Amazon onboarding process. So, I tell you about mine because I'm fairly new and, you know, I remember it very well because I just did it. It's funny for me because for the last decade since I've been over here, and even when I was teaching in the US, I was advising companies to take onboarding a lot more seriously. Mm-hmm. And I'm now in a company that does. And that's really cool. And I'm actually doing onboarding. So that's even better.
Okay, cool.
So we do take it seriously. Now, what I really appreciated about the onboarding process here at Amazon is that I was told on day one that my job for the first 3 months was to learn. Not to deliver, but to learn. And that's the normal expectation here. That's common. We want to invest the time early on so that we can get better performance from somebody down the road. So we want to make that investment right up front. Now, my own onboarding was a mixture of one-to-one conversations with people, shadowing meetings, taking online training, a lot of self-paced online training, and doing reverse shadowing where I would lead events and my colleagues would be watching me just to make sure everything was on track. And that was really good. So those are kind of the bits and pieces, the main bits and pieces, if you will, of the onboarding. And then one of the things that really helped was, you know, I sit here in Singapore. I'm the executive onboarding partner for APJC, Asia Pacific, Japan, China. I'm the only one in the region who does this. The rest of my team is mostly in the United States with one person who sits in Milan covering EMEA, Europe and Middle East, Africa. So my team's not here and that could make it hard to onboard. And I ended up being kind of adopted by the executive recruiting team here in Asia, which we partner with a lot, but we're on different teams. And also I worked with the Southeast Asia HR team.
We just had a technical outage. I'm sitting here in Germany while recording, and Will is in Singapore. And once again, we've discovered that Singapore has the better lines, the better internet connectivity than Germany does. So we'll try to pick up our podcast at this point. And the question that we're basically going through the onboarding process at Amazon. And Will, you were explaining basically, originally I had asked you how the onboarding process is for the new hires. And you said then you will basically give us that explanation from your perspective as you were yourself just recently, right? A new hire? How long back is it now?
I have only been here 16 months. So this
only
is
16 months. Okay.
Yeah. Which actually, in Amazon terms is actually pretty long. But it seems because we are a very young company. We have a lot of, you know, young junior folks. But I went through this process starting in July of 2022. And one of the things that I will say up front is that I have spent much of the last decade as an HR consultant and advisor and coach and HR professor telling companies they need to take onboarding seriously. And I'm finally at a company that does, that takes it, that really emphasizes it, as demonstrated by the fact that I do executive onboarding, you know, for a living. So let me describe, if I can, the onboarding process that that all of our employees would go through. Executive onboarding is a little bit different, but what the bulk of our employees are going to go through starts when they arrive. And I will say from the beginning that what I appreciated was that on day one, I was told my job for the next 3 months was to learn, not to worry about delivering anything. It was all about learning for those 3 months. And that I think is really valuable for the company because we invest the time at the beginning to get the best performance out of people over the long run, rather than saying, welcome to the company. This Start is due working. In 3 weeks. Yeah. You know, give it to us. So
the strategy of learning in your case is very much not as some of the older listeners might know, or, you know, the strategy used to be, you know, basically kick somebody in the pool at the deep end. And if they swim, they stay. And if they drown, they're out, you know. So basically, and, you know, those that struggled and survived were basically fit for the company, and those that didn't were not. So that was one of the, I think, learning techniques used back in the day. And I'm glad to hear that that's not that way. And when you describe it, I see a little bit of a parallel to how I, for example, approach project management. And that is that, you know, the heavy lifting is done at the beginning of the project. In this case, you give your new hires and your employees the chance to learn and to get acclimated before you expect them to actually perform, which is, you know, kind of like you do in a project. You know, if you get everything set up at the beginning, so if you invest enough time, or you do the invest in the beginning, then you're sure that at the end you'll have a better outcome, which in essence, I think, is what you're shooting for.
Yeah, yeah. And we do find that we have a better outcome that way, because people know that they have 3 months where asking questions is not only okay, but it is encouraged. Mm-hmm. And I have seen very often in companies that have either been clients of mine or that have been employers of mine, where if you start asking questions, people look at you like you're like, there's something wrong with you. Like, why did we hire you if you don't know that? Well, you know, I've been in the company 2 weeks. I'm not supposed to know that yet. That's why I, yeah. So, you know, we try to avoid that. And so the way this works is you come in and, you know, you're told this is your job for the next 3 months is to learn. And realistically, in 100% of the cases, does that happen? Probably not. Depending upon, you know, the needs of the business, there may be certainly some disruption there. But that's the idea, is to learn up front. And to do that, on the first day, the new employee gets a 3-month onboarding plan, which is very structured with specific activities, with training, with people they should meet, and it's broken down by weekly and monthly goals. So their manager goes through this with them and says, this is what we're looking for in the first 3 months. These are the expectations we have. One of the most useful elements of that we have is what we call key Amazonians to meet. And it is a list of people whom you should meet and why you should meet them.
Interesting.
Which is incredibly helpful in a global matrixed company, because when you get started, you may be told somebody is a stakeholder, but you don't know why. And you don't know what the relationship is until you get in there and start having those conversations. Something that I recommend to new leaders when they have those key Amazonian discussions is the last question they should ask is, who else should I talk to? So that list of key Amazonians is a starting point, not an end point. And it helps them with their relationship building down the road.
And it makes it also very dynamic, because, you know, things change all the time. So those key individuals, there might be other individuals that have moved into different positions. So there might be slight adjustments. So it's very nice. Okay, good.
It is. It's very helpful for finding some of those, you know, those hidden networks. You know, we talk about solid line relationships and dotted line relationships, but there are an awful lot of invisible line relationships. And you need to know what those are. And at some point, you got to start learning. So we said, why not start learning at the beginning? And that's what we do. Something else that is very useful that I experienced, and I've seen others do this too, is throughout your onboarding, it helps to have a task that helps you capture the knowledge gained from your onboarding and use it in your work going forward. Because that helps you focus your knowledge gathering during your onboarding, and it kind of gives it some purpose. So, for example, as I said, I'm the executive onboarding partner for Asia Pacific, Japan, China, APJC. I'm the only one over here. I'm the first one over here. So during my onboarding, I did a needs assessment for the unique requirements we would have in different Asian countries here compared to the norm that they use in North America. Or what they use in Western in Europe. And
was this a task, just quick interruption to understand, was this a task that was assigned to you, or one that you might have worked together with your, do you have a classic mentor or something like that in place? Was it something that was assigned to you, or did you work on it together and come up with this? You know, sometimes tasks are simply assigned, and other times, you go in with your new hire and say, okay, what tasks do you think that we can accomplish with you? And then you kind of matched that. So this task, how was that? How did that come about?
Yeah, this was straight up assigned to me. Mm-hmm. So this is something my manager shared with me that first week, that mm-hmm. this was one of the onboarding expectations. This is what they'd like me to be able to do in 90 days. Mm-hmm. The real advantage to that was that as I was doing those key Amazonian conversations and meeting with different stakeholders around the region and back in the States and other places, I knew that at the end of those 3 months, I needed to write up a needs assessment for APJC. Mm-hmm. So my questions focused on the work I was going to be doing, focused on the needs of my internal clients here. It focused on what others had observed, you know, before I got here, so that I could step in and you know, have some history rather mm-hmm. than just starting from zero. And so what this task did is it provided some focus to my onboarding, and it was in such a way that I could then use it. So at 3 months and 1 day, when I mm-hmm. kind of go into delivery mode, now I've got tasks that I want to accomplish over the next year, things that I want to do, projects I mm-hmm. want to explore. This isn't just a homework assignment that ends up, mm-hmm. you know, in a filing cabinet somewhere. This actually gets used. And I think that's very, very helpful during an onboarding process to be able to capture the knowledge you're gaining and apply mm-hmm. it to something down the road. Very, very helpful.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Okay. So, wow. With that explanation, you ran through a couple of the questions that I was going to ask because you did such a nice job encompassing everything. So there are, of course, as a global company, there are unique things. And one of the things that I think all companies have been challenged with, of course, with Corona, is in their onboarding. We've had changes in our company too, that we've had to go from like a face-to-face to a hybrid approach. Now, is this something that in Amazon, was Corona for you an accelerator in that manner, or did you already have a hybrid? Because when you explained it, 16 months, you're about on the cusp there. Mm-hmm. I would assume that Amazon already had a hybrid approach installed. So you probably during Corona moved to, you know, more the technical and side of it. So in other words, you probably removed some of the face-to-face elements and did more conferencing. But take us through that, if you've always had a hybrid approach, and how and what your opinion is of a hybrid approach.
Yeah. Well, I think to some degree, Amazon would have had a hybrid approach before my arrival and before coronavirus, actually, because, mm-hmm. you know, in a global matrixed company, a lot of the people with whom you're going to be working and from whom you're going to be learning are not sitting there in your office. They're not even on your continent in some cases. So you're going to have that online element to it. There's also some training opportunities. It's like some classroom training sorts of opportunities, and where you can do those in person, you mm-hmm. do. And mm-hmm. and where you have to do it virtually, you do it virtually. And mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that I've seen just since being here is that it's easier, of course, in the United States, for example, to have an in-person class because you have an awful lot of people there who need that class. And mm-hmm. so if you're in Seattle or if you're in New York or if you're in, you know, the Bay Area or other places, you can bring a lot of people together. You know, here in Singapore, I might have one person who needs that class. So they're not going to take it here. And in some cases, we can fly them back to Seattle, but we'd like to have a little more of a reason than just a two-day class to mm-hmm. put them on a plane for 16 hours. So, you know, so there ends up being quite a bit of online training, online mm-hmm. courses, both real time and self-paced, you know, online training as well. And it works. It works. And I think part of what helps with that, part of what keeps a hybrid onboarding process seamless is mm-hmm. just to be very deliberate about your planning, very deliberate about how you do the onboarding, and very intentional in the way that you do it. And that is something that drives, I mean, a lot of our activities here. But mm-hmm. one of the things I think has really helped our onboarding here is that there's a lot of thought that goes into it even before that person arrives, before that new hire arrives. Mm-hmm. And certainly for executive onboarding, the way we do that, we have an opportunity to identify any gaps in the onboarding before that person arrives, and we can bring everything together so that they have a very cohesive plan. One of the things too that I think helps with that, once you're executing on that plan, mm-hmm. is when you have one-on-one conversations, whether virtual or in person, you've got group meetings, you've got classes, you have self-paced learning, bring the material from one event or one activity mm-hmm. into your other activities. So if you're okay. doing self-paced training online, bring what you learn into your one-on-one conversations, bring what you learn into your group sessions and talk about it with people. Don't okay. just let these be separate, discrete events, but instead tie it all together. Okay. Just tie it okay. all together. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So once again, you hit out on a whole bunch of topics. You covered it all. And
conciseness is not one of my leadership principles, I'm afraid.
Well, it basically led into to the other couple of questions, and that was, you know, how do you make everything seamless, and what challenges you had? And I think you already addressed the topic of challenges in the sense that for you specifically in the Asian region, one of the challenges might be that you simply don't have that much manpower for getting a face-to-face course together. So if you only have one person that needs the course versus Seattle who has 20 people, then it's of course easier to organize such an online course, such a face-to-face course. So, so that makes sense too. And then you also said how you basically get this seamless thing. And that was one approach that I thought maybe it's kind of like in the back of your head subconsciously, but now that you address it, it's definitely out there. And that is what what my opinion is, was when you address the seamlessly to integrate the online training with the face-to-face with, you know, maybe individual studies to make those things basically have some type of crossover and to have the topic match. And that's really interesting because maybe that's where some other companies or businesses might be a little bit off in the sense that they compartmentalize. Okay, you're going to do online training, which will teach you this specific thing. And then you go to face-to-face teaching you this specific thing. And then you do this and that's that specific thing. And in the grand picture, of course, you need to learn each one of these skills and things, but they're not quite consciously connected. So, and like you also said, one of the things that you had is when you were given a task at the beginning of your training, and you took that 3 months to already with a foresight in your questioning and your engagement with the other individuals that you had taking you through that, to basically already work towards that goal. So I think that's a very, very, a lot of good points that I think some companies might be doing subconsciously, but by you mentioning it, you know, it brings it back and it's like, it's clear. So I don't think it's anything like super complicated, but sometimes it's nice to have clear words, and then it just pops into place. And that's, I think your explanation there is perfect. The question though, that I have, since we talked about culture, how do you integrate, you've already alluded to it a little bit, but how do you integrate the cultural onboarding, which is bringing somebody into the mindset of being an Amazonian with the, you know, necessity of also learning specific skills for the job. So be it programming, whatever, or hosting. But you have two separate tasks that you have to combine in one. So how does that work for you? How do you work that?
Well, I think in part, that's one reason we dedicate 3 months to this, mm-hmm. is we do have to do both of those, and they both take time. And you can't just, you don't want to just, you know, scratch the surface on the culture, and you don't want to scratch the surface on the functional mm-hmm. training. You want to get down into the details. So I think having that time is valuable. Part of what helps also is having this onboarding plan, which, as I said, is very structured, is broken down by various timelines, and using that gives you an opportunity to prioritize, you know, whether it's focusing on the culture or focusing on the tech, for example, focusing on the technical skills. And, you know, you can balance that over the course of those 3 months. So it could be that perhaps you spend most of your first month focused on the cultural aspects because you need to be able to speak the language of the Amazonian before you can use your skills in an Amazonian way. You know, we want you to get that foundation and then focus perhaps more on the functional skills that we need to develop. And then we'll, you know, then we'll blend the two and take you forward. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's great. Well, I think the thing that you already mentioned, which I really liked, what'd you call it? The leadership principles? Yeah, that. And I thought that was really, really nice and interesting. In other companies, I've heard referred to it as a vision statement. Although I would tend to say most of the vision statements are, I have a feeling sometimes a little abstract.
Yes.
So a little hard to reach. How would you, since you've, you know, worked in different companies, worked on your own and also coach, how would you relate those two as seeing as this, you know, the leadership principles, I think, are one of the key components here that you have to becoming an Amazonian. So how would you describe that?
Yeah. So I would definitely see a relationship between all of those, the mission, vision, and the leadership principles. So the way I would break it down is the vision is what we want the world to look like, you know, when we do what we do. Like what impact do we want to have? What do we want to bring to the world? The mission is what we're going to do to get us to there, to that vision. And then the leadership principles are how we execute that mission. And one way to maybe think about the leadership principles is they provide some guardrails around the actions that we take and the way that we work. I mean, they provide guidance and they let us know that this is the way we want to operate because it's worked, you know, and we see that this is the right thing to do. Going outside of these principles is not the way we want to operate. It's not the kind of company we want to be. So maybe think about it that way, that the leadership principles help you accomplish your mission, and your mission is what gets you to your vision. I agree with you. A lot of times vision statements are very abstract. I think they're also essential because if you don't know where you're going, then you can never get there. Yeah.
That is correct. That I have to agree with that. So let's complete this chapter then. In the onboarding process, what would you say is something that you would say is uniquely Amazon?
What is uniquely Amazon? Yeah, that is a good one. I would say, you mean just about the onboarding process itself, like about the way we do onboarding? What is unique?
What would you, I mean, you know, if you had to say, what is, you've worked in several companies and everybody has their own thing, but since we're talking about onboarding, in this process of onboarding, what would you say struck you as uniquely Amazon that you may have not encountered otherwise, and that you say, that's something that we do that probably, well, okay, saying nobody else does it is a little bit extensive, but you know, it's one of the things that you're like, wow, okay, if that's one thing that I had to mention, that would be it.
Yeah. I think what sets us apart there, and I certainly don't know that nobody else does this, but I think what really has caught my attention is the emphasis on the culture in the onboarding. I have been in organizations before where onboarding consists of getting your business cards, you know, getting your email set up. There's a lot of compliance training you have to do, and you check the box and you move on. You may have functional skills that you need to learn, and we talked about this earlier, the balance between learning the culture and learning the function. I've generally seen an emphasis on the function. I have not experienced the emphasis on culture that I see here. And, you know, my PhD focuses on organizational culture, so I'm loving it. I'm loving every minute of this. And I just think that, that is something that really does set us apart. Yeah. People really do live and breathe the culture here. And that stems, I think, from the onboarding. Yeah.
Okay. So we've gotten through that part of it, and now you do the onboarding, but of course, for you, there's also the process of how do you track the experience? How do you ensure that the experience is what it needs to be for the employee? So how do you go about feedbacking once you go through? I mean, I don't know. Do you finish like the, do you wait to the end of the onboarding, or do you have times where you have like earlier feedback rounds to gauge how the onboarding is going for the employee? Do you have KPIs? Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah, we are all about feedback. We are a very data-oriented company. And if there's an opportunity to grab feedback and make use of it, we're going to do that. So how do we do that? So there's a couple of ways that we think about it. One is feedback on an individual case, you know, an individual onboarding case, just to make sure everything's on track. And then feedback on the onboarding process in general. When it comes to gathering feedback on an individual, and when somebody comes in to, when most employees come in, we think of the onboarding process as being 3 months. When I work with executives, we actually think of it as it's a 12-month process. So they stay with that, they stay on our radar for 12 months. And we gather feedback through feedback surveys at the 3 month and 6 month point. And that's designed to measure engagement and their onboarding satisfaction. And when I am working with execs, I really emphasize this to them in my initial meetings with them about how valuable this is. And I think as a result of pushing this so much, we get really high response rates. So that's really, really valuable. And that helps us see how an individual is doing. And if there is a need to step in and help them with anything or provide some resources or course correct that emerges from those surveys, then we have the opportunity to do that. We have a lot of conversational feedback. I will meet with an exec multiple times during their onboarding process. We also do check-ins with their hiring manager and their HR business partner at the 3 month point. And then if they wish at the 6, 9, and 12 month point, just to see how everything's going. So again, getting feedback on that individual, that also gives us some feedback on the process as a whole. And that's something else that we look at. So we do some of our own research studies within the team. In some cases, it's sparked by feedback we get. In other cases, it's by opportunities that we see. Something seems to be working, and we want to explore that further. And we'll do that research and turn around and create new mechanisms or new programs or products for people based on that broader research of the whole onboarding process.
Okay. Then let's wrap up the topic then with my final question, and that is... have you observed any notable improvements in employee retention or performance because of your onboarding efforts? Because we just talked about, you know, measuring feedback and so forth and so on. So I think this is a good follow-up question in the sense that what have you gotten out of it? Or,
Yeah, so we measure kind of the KPIs we focus on are performance and attrition rates over the first year. So we want somebody to come in and start doing well and stay with us through that first year. And that's where we're really measuring. And those are the KPIs, the most critical ones, I would say, that we look at from the onboarding team. Now, what have we seen from that? Well, a lot of improvement. And we've only recently been able to say that definitively because we've only been doing executive onboarding. And this is, again, this is where my field is. We've only been doing executive onboarding for, you know, maybe 3 years or so. And so this is still a relatively new thing for us. And we finally have a large enough sample size to be able to look at people who've been in our onboarding program versus people who weren't, you know, who came into the company before we did executive onboarding. And we did a study in 2022, an analysis of what we call key drivers of executive success. And what we found was that the collective impact of AWS's executive onboarding program reduced the odds, statistically significantly reduced the odds of a new executive experiencing a performance problem or an attrition problem in their first year.
Wow.
And when I say the executive onboarding programs, you know, the collective impact, it's not just my teammates and I. Who are awesome, by the way. I love working with this team. But we partner up with the hiring manager, with the HR business partner. Every new hire gets as an onboarding buddy who's helping them. They have an Amazon advisor who helps them with their culture. So it's like another buddy, if you will. If they're a leader, they've got their direct reports helping them. We have different teams that we work with to provide the products that help with onboarding. Mm-hmm. And all of that together has contributed to show a statistically significant drop in performance and attrition issues since we started this program.
I just realized that some questions should not be asked. And I think you just ended the question in such a manner that I have a feeling we just lightly scratched the surface of all this. And we've been in here for about an hour already. Yeah. So kind of went full circle, because now you just opened up a whole new thing and piqued my curiosity, at least, to get even into more topics. I mean, you did an excellent job, by the way, I think, of covering both the general things and since you said you're mostly responsible for the leadership aspect of it. But I think you gave us a pretty good insight of what you do and of Amazon, a little bit of peek behind the curtain, so to say, to see how Amazon operates. And I think there's a lot of things that may not be groundbreaking, but it's the application sometimes of the simplest things and applied in the correct manner that seem to have the best results. You know, sometimes we could say common sense applied correctly. And I think that is fascinating to see. And the other thing that I think is fascinating, which, again, you opened up a can of worms at the end of your discussion, was, which I didn't get to touch to earlier, is this complete structure. Because in the beginning, we did talk about onboarding, but I didn't realize how many individuals and how many departments are actually involved in making this happen. So it's not simply the little itty bitty department of onboarding, but it's all these other departments working together in concert to achieve this task. So I think that's a very interesting thing that we came out at the end of the podcast here too. We always try to give our listeners a little bit of a nugget of information or something that they can, you know, take with them. So, what would you say is the key takeaway for our podcast listeners that will help them? We'll make it a two-part question. A, in their daily life, and B, in their work life.
Okay. Actually, I think my nugget here is going to affect both daily life.
Okay, that's good.
And that is...
Now you're being concise.
I'm trying. And that would be that you do not get a second chance to make a first impression.
Okay.
And I think that is just as true if you're the new executive or new employee coming in. Mm-hmm. Then, obviously people like to think about that. But your company, your organization gets one chance to make a first impression on that new employee.
Ah, okay.
And it's very important to get that right. And, you know, you talked earlier about how, you know, a lot of things may be happening subconsciously. And that's great if they are, but we don't rely on that. We're deliberate. We're intentional. Mm-hmm. We take those subconscious things and we make them conscious. And I think that's what you need to do. Be deliberate about the way you bring people into your organization. Don't just rely on good intentions to create that good relationship from the start. Actually have a plan and have a framework for creating that relationship between the employee and the organization, because it's a lot easier to get it right at the start than it is to try to go back and fix it later.
Yep. That's the old additive that I use always in project management. If you have a good start, if you screw it up at the start, it's really hard. It's an uphill battle after that. So, those two things kind of mesh, but I think that was a very, very valuable nugget, which you also expanded upon. So thank you very, very much. And for the final question, of course, is if you were to recommend either a further guest for the podcast or a further topic, what would you recommend in either the guest or the topic that we cover in one of our future podcasts?
I think a great topic would be something, it goes back to something that you mentioned earlier and that we talked about, which is working remotely.
And working remotely, okay.
Yeah, you know, I think it would be great to take a really in-depth look at the true impact of working remotely or working from home that has on productivity. Because when the pandemic started, we all worried that, everyone has to go home and now this isn't going to work. And then it did. Mm-hmm. And then there were studies that said, productivity's gone up. And lately we're hearing, studies say productivity's going down. well, which is it? And I think it would be great to separate the signal from the noise and really do an in-depth look at what the studies are actually saying about productivity in remote work, and then take what we can from that and go forward.
Okay. Boy, I hate and love you at the same time. You open up another can on me, and I could just go off on this topic because it's something that I've been faced with, and that also interests me is this. My work life has basically been mainly focused on going to a location, doing your job, and then leaving that location. So being on site. So working out of a home office in a hybrid fashion has been interesting. Where I also have to say, though, however, working completely remotely, I would consider a little bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. But exactly those are the questions that need to be answered. And that discussion is, I think, one of the things that is burning, you know, everybody from Elon Musk to whoever is talking about it is, you know, do the employees have to go to work, come, you know, back to work? Can they work hybrid? Can they work remote? Personally, I'm just going to throw my hat in the ring. I live for personal interaction. So having the opportunity to talk to somebody face to face in a physical form rather than solely virtual is for me, that's the essence. So I'll put my hat in the ring. I would prefer to at least have the opportunity to maybe the hybrid solution is the best. So sometimes at home because it gives you the flexibility, but I also value very, very, very much the actual physical interaction with my colleagues, with my leads and so forth and so on. So I appreciate that very much. Okay.
Yeah. And I got to say, I'm with you on that.
We're old school.
I spent 6 years, like I said, running my own business, and I was basically working from my dining room table. Okay. And then I went back to corporate at another company prior to Amazon. And I thought, hey, I'm back in the office. And then here comes the pandemic and they're all going home again. So I got to say, I'm actually happy to be back in offices now for exactly that reason. Having that interaction with people is just so valuable. Yeah. So I appreciate the chance to actually see human beings. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll take that. That point up, and I'll put it toward to my editing. Get my editing staff on it, and then maybe we can come up with a couple of individuals. Or maybe I'll have to invite you for a second round of a talk because we obviously have unfinished business. It's kind of like boxing. you got the first round, and I have to come back for a rematch because there's so many questions still, I think, open, and so many things that I think you can still share, which are simply fascinating to me. And I think they're also fascinating for our listeners. So, Will, I thank you very, very much for making yourself available, for giving us some insight on AWS, Amazon Web Services. And it was a joy having you on this podcast.
Well, it was a real pleasure. This is a great series, and I'm thrilled to be a part of it. So thanks so much for having me with you.
Great. So as always, if you like the podcast, smash the like button, or even better, subscribe. And thanks for listening. Till next time, this was The Learning Curve with Kenny.
This podcast is brought to you by MC Learning, and we'll release a new episode every month. I'm your host, Kenneth Littlepage. Editorial planning and script by Simon Breslaw and Vanessa Klaes. Post-production and design, Lars Knuck. If you like the episode, we would be happy if you subscribe to our podcast and recommend it to your friends and colleagues.